I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Rarely do we get a good news story about teenagers, but today is different. Teens in Memphis, many living in public housing, spent the summer mapping their neighborhood and its assets. And even they were surprised by what they learned. We'll talk to Dr. Charlie Santo from the University of Memphis, who designed and directed the project. Also with us is Wayne Senville, who spent his summer traveling Route 50 from Maryland to California, talking to citizens and planning commissioners in towns along the way. We'll find out what he learned today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Charlie Santo is Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning in the School of Urban Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Memphis. He is also the coordinator of the Planning Innovations Technology Lab at the university. Charlie previously served as Principal Planner for Housing and Neighborhood Preservation with the City of Richmond, Virginia. Charlie, what was the inspiration for the Youth Mapping Initiative in Memphis?
Well, for me, you know, I've come to the kind of a personal realization that if we want to create and maintain sustainable, healthy communities and cities, then we really need to focus on children and families. And, you know, Memphis, like a lot of other cities, is tending to lose a large number of its healthy families to the suburbs. And that causes our metro area to grow and spread out in terms of footprint without our population growing at all. So it's sort of the opposite of smart growth. And, you know, we can do a lot to bring empty nesters back to downtown lofts and condos, and we can focus on attracting young professionals. But if those young professionals, when they become couples and start having children, if they feel like they have to leave the city when their kids become school age, then we're not really creating that strong and vibrant and lasting community that we want. And when we lose the kids, I think we sort of start to lose the soul of the community. So I feel like we need to find ways to make this city and cities in general more attractive to healthy families, to make cities more kid-friendly. So to do that, why not start with getting a youth perspective on what kids or youth think make a good place to live or a bad place to live? What do they like and what do they dislike? And so, you know, we've been thinking about that, and we've become aware of the work of David Driscoll and others with the UNESCO Growing Up in Cities project, which has been featured on the Smart City program. And we'd heard Louise Chawla talk about her involvement with it here at a local conference at the University of Memphis. And we thought, well, why not apply some of those ideas here with some of our young people? And the City of Memphis, the Summer Youth Employment Program, gave us an opportunity to do that, to get some kids involved. So partly for me it's that, and then part it's also, you know, let's give a hand to those kids who are living in our city neighborhoods and give them some opportunities and help them engage with their community and recognize the assets that exist, make sure that they have positive feelings and positive experiences with their neighborhoods in the city.
How does the perspective of kids differ from that of adults?
I don't know that it did all that much. I mean, for kids, in terms of assets, we focused a lot on helping them identify assets and liabilities and then building from there, building a final project that they would work on from there. And in terms of liabilities, it was easy for them to identify liabilities quickly, and it was generally safety and physical appearance. But those are the things that we sort of tend to dwell on the negative, especially in the media and in policy making. We make policies in reaction to those negative things. And in doing that, we sort of lose sight of the assets. And so doing this project helped these kids sort of recognize the assets in their neighborhoods. Hey, we have parks. We have things that we can walk to in these urban neighborhoods. We know our neighbors. We have this sense of community. We've got these unique things like the candy lady who lives down the street where you can go and buy, you know, a bag of candy. And we have the snow cone lady. And we have this great history and heritage that's become forgotten. And so our thought was, if we can get these kids interested in these assets and connect them with the assets, then those thoughts sort of trickle up to the parents and trickle out to the broader community.
Let's back up. Describe the project as it was conceived and as it was executed.
Okay. Well, it started, we got a contact from the city in their office of Youth Services and Community Affairs, who runs this summer youth employment program. And basically what that is, the city has this chunk of money that they use to employ teens, not only to keep them occupied and help them out financially, but to provide some workplace skills, specific skills and sort of general workplace behavior. And they had contacted us at the School of Urban Affairs and Public Policy to see if we could place some of these kids. And so we came up, you know, and because I'd been thinking about that focus on children and families and cities, we decided, well, we could get involved in this and we could try to do something. So the objectives that we came up with were one, to build skills and to give these kids some city planning related skills and expose them to careers in city planning. Give them some hard skills in computer mapping and using geographic information systems, which become sort of widely applicable skills that they can use. And then also, we have this broader set of objectives, which were, to teach these kids to recognize and take pride in and build on the assets in their neighborhood, and to teach them, when it comes to liabilities, to seek solutions rather than just dwelling on liabilities. And to teach them that they can be or are stakeholders in their neighborhood. And so the way the program worked is it was an 8-week program, and we had two groups of kids, a total of 15 kids working in two groups in two different neighborhoods. One in a neighborhood called Peabody Vance, which is sort of just on the edge of downtown, one of the oldest neighborhoods in the city. And then the other working in the University District, which is kind of a group of neighborhoods that are adjacent to the university. And we worked with these kids for 8 weeks, for 6 hours a day. And we started off the program in terms of what the final product would be, the final outcome, was designed to be totally flexible. So we started with sort of a general curriculum to introduce them to thinking like a city planner, thinking about community and neighborhoods and geography, physical space and how physical environment affects the way you feel, and mostly teaching them to recognize assets and liabilities. And then we taught them, we introduced the technology. And we wanted to put the technology twist on it, again, to give them those widely applicable skills in using computer mapping and geographic information system, and also to make it more interesting to the kids, because kids tend to get into technology. And so we introduced them to the technology, and then we said, well, now you know how to think like a planner. You've defined what you think are important assets and liabilities. What do you want to do? And that flexibility to us when we were setting it up was kind of scary, because we didn't know how to prepare. We didn't know if we were going to end up doing, you know, mapping vacant lots and talking about community gardens, or mapping trees, talking about urban forestry. But we really wanted the project to be an authentic reflection of the youth perspective, so we had to leave it open-ended. And they were really able to narrow down what they wanted to focus on and what they wanted their final products to be. The two groups ended up doing very completely different products in terms of outcome.
The students took an intelligent approach, focus on assets, then study success. Was that a result of your direction or their own intuitive approach?
It was part of the structure. We wanted to structure this like a mini planning process. So we would start with, you know, understanding our environment, understanding our surroundings and what exists now, and identifying what we like and what we don't like about it. And focus on, and again, we wanted to focus, we could have focused more on liabilities, because there are certainly obvious liabilities, but they hear enough of that in their regular everyday lives and on the news that we really wanted to focus on, hey, let's build up these assets. So that was, we intentionally set it up that way, and we had to continually, in times it was difficult, particularly with the Peabody Vance group. The majority of the kids that were involved over there lived in public housing. There are two very large public housing complexes in that neighborhood. And so we had problems kind of overcoming this very pervasive and deeply ingrained negativity and negative perceptions. And it took us a while to sort of find ways to get them to recognize the assets. And, you know, tying it to the civil rights movement, I think was important for them. And it was interesting because it's not the assets that are there, once you learn about them, it's so obvious how important they are, but, you know, they didn't know about them, their parents didn't know about them, and I'm certain that the rest of the folks in the city don't know about them. And it's those kind of things that we need to get out there and get people to recognize so that these neighborhoods can reach their potential, especially that neighborhood because of its location. I mean, it's you know, a couple blocks from Beale Street and the FedEx Forum, and it's right near downtown, and it's adjacent to what's going on in the Soulsville neighborhood, that there's so much potential there that we really need to get people to recognize. And that's what these kids are trying to do.
What effect do you think the development of an asset map might have on the students?
I think that they certainly know things now that they didn't know when we started. And when we started, on the first day, you know, the first thing I asked them was, how many of you love your neighborhood? And very few, one of them said, I love my neighborhood. The rest of them, meh. and then the other thing we asked them was, we gave them a quick survey just to kind of get their perspective. We asked them to tell us what neighborhood you live in. And, you know, we intentionally wanted to figure out, what are they going to identify themselves with Peabody Vance the way we identify that neighborhood, or are they going to call it something else? And we expected them to call it something else. And over there, the majority of them, I think all of them, when we asked them what neighborhood you live in, they gave us the name of their public housing complex. And that was their whole world. Inside the gates of that complex is what they identify themselves with. And so now I think that they see themselves as part of a broader community, and they see the assets that exist, and they want to tell people about them. And, you know, that's one thing we tried to do is make them think from that perspective. We were constantly telling them, you know, if there was an investor coming in here, or if you had the mayor in here, what would you want them to know about this neighborhood? And so that kind of got them to think in that way.
Let me interrupt. I would think that the message to the mayor and to a developer would be very different. To the mayor, the message might be, look at the problems we need you to fix. And to a developer, the message might be very different. Check out these assets that everyone has overlooked.
Well, I think early on we asked them what, you know, on the first or second day, what can you do about the problems that exist in your neighborhood? We'll write a letter to the mayor and tell him, you need to fix this, and you need to get us this garbage can. So we wanted to get them out of the mentality of thinking, let's contact other people so we can tell them what problems. Instead, get them thinking, you know, here's why our neighborhood is worth your attention. One thing that they did that really helps us sort of track how they progressed over time, and anybody can look at it, is both groups kept blogs. You know, we debated about whether we should edit things like grammar and their use of sort of street slang, and we decided not to just because we wanted it to be authentic. But, you know, you can see in there how their perspectives change, and by the end, when they're writing about the Peabody Vance Group, when they're writing about, here's our final product, here's the asset maps we created, you know, I think you can see their pride in not only what they learned how to do, but what they learned about their neighborhood that they want people to know about.
Some people might think, if you want to improve the neighborhood, why not put the students to work repairing houses or cleaning up the park? Did you run into that sort of thinking?
Not really. I mean, because the city had come to us and said, well, what can you guys at SUAP do in terms of, you know, exposing these participants to careers? And so we really wanted to focus on giving them skills and knowledge that city planners would use. So, you know, the city summer youth employment program placed participants with all different kinds of agencies and organizations throughout the city. So I'm sure there were plenty of kids that were doing those things this summer.
Did the city planning department participate in any way?
We actually had connections with a variety of agencies. One was the city's housing and community development. When the kids over in the university district did their property condition survey, collected all that data, they went and shared it with housing and community development. And, you know, one interesting thing that happened with that is they shared the data and they said, you know, here are the problem properties, here's our report. And the folks at HCD said, well, you did that using handheld computers? That's cool. Show us how to do that. They want to do a citywide property condition survey, and they were getting ready to do it, you know, with a clipboard and a pen. And so they're learning from these kids that you can do this a lot easier using technology.
And did you provide the technology?
Yeah, well, I've had meetings with the staff over there and showed them, you know, gave them the specs and showed them how to use it. And I think that they're trying to find they may have found the funding to purchase some of the equipment, and I'll have to follow up with them to make sure that's happening. But the kids felt really proud about that they were, you know, showing the city agency how to do it.
You've been clear about the effect you hope to have on the kids. What did you hope would be the effect on the neighborhood?
Well, in one sense, it's sharing the data that we collected with the neighborhood, especially the property condition survey. We were able to share that in a presentation to the neighborhood. And hopefully some of the things that the kids identified will sort of live on. Like, for example, the park redesign. The executive director of the University Neighborhood Development Corporation, which is a private CDC, was at that presentation, and he's trying to set up a meeting with the City of Memphis Park Services Division to actually talk about implementing some of those changes. So that's kind of an ongoing thing and an impact we can have in that community. You know, and then in terms of just the idea of people recognizing these assets and sharing them with their parents and with their neighbors and with kids at school, and maybe that pride spreads a little bit. And we try to make as many connections with neighborhood organizations as we could, because we know that, you know, when you're in a planning process, you can't just come in as an outsider and say, we're going to tell you what you need to do to fix this neighborhood. And we didn't want to come in and say, we're going to take your kids and tell them, you know, what's good and bad about this neighborhood, because it's not our neighborhood. So the first thing we did was meet with CDC's neighborhood groups that were working in the area and make those connections. We connected with the New Pathways CDC in the Peabody Vance area. And, you know, they were very interested, and they came and met with us a couple times, and they had been working with other youth that were doing property condition surveys and trying to find owners of derelict properties, reporting code violations and those sorts of things. So they shared that with us, and we shared our data with them. And we've shared the Peabody Vance group has shared their interactive maps that they've created with the local branch library in their neighborhood. And so hopefully the idea is that when people come into the library, the librarian who had worked with the kids and came to our open house, that she'll say, hey, do you want to see these maps that these kids created? And that way the rest of the neighborhood gets to see those assets that maybe they didn't realize were there either.
Do you have a second act, another way you imagine using students to improve neighborhoods, or do you plan to repeat the project again?
You know, I'm not sure. I'd like to do this again, and I think that the city is interested in doing it again. I'm not sure exactly what the next step is going to be. We have other projects that we're thinking about doing. One is working with younger kids. And that's one thing I'd like to do in the future, if possible, is to do this with younger kids, because I think the earlier you can make that impact and get them interested and engaged in their community, the better. We're trying to put together a project with kids at a local elementary school, a campus school, which is actually a Memphis City school that's located here on the campus of the University of Memphis, and get them involved in using some of the same technology, the handheld computers and the mobile GIS, doing a tree inventory on and around the campus. Getting them engaged in the community and recognizing assets again and learning about technology. So that's one thing that we're thinking about. But yeah, I'd like to do something like this project again.
Dr. Charlie Santo is Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning in the School of Urban Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Memphis. Keith Bellows is editor of my favorite travel magazine, National Geographic Traveler. Keith, in your July-August issue, you featured two U.S. cities, Las Vegas and Sacramento. I can't think of two cities that are, at least on the surface, more different. What did you find to like about Las Vegas?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was just in Las Vegas about 3 months ago with some friends, and I had never been there before, and you know, I have that classic preconception of Las Vegas as being sort of an artificial city. What really surprised me was there is the Las Vegas that we all know. It's the sort of the faux world. But then there's this other Las Vegas, you know, where you've got, you've got great art. I actually went to see the Beatles Love, which is a terrific Cirque du Soleil piece, which I found was art. And, you know, so we think of slots, and yet there was a lot more there than I'd expected. Great food, unbelievable food. L'Atelier, probably one of the best restaurants I've been to in a long, long time. That's Joel Robuchon's L'Atelier, which is at the MGM Grand. Amazing stuff.
You don't sound like you're much of a fan of what you call the Las Vegas faux world. Does it interrupt your experience as a traveler and having a good time?
You know, I think about, you know, I'm not a big fan of the faux world, but I think that in a certain sense, you need that kind of world because some folks, and there's no criticism here at all, some folks love it. I'm glad they love it. It's a great opportunity for people to have a great time. I can't remember a place that I've been to where I saw so many people having so much time for so long at all hours of the day and night. So clearly, it's really an attraction for a lot of people. It's just not my kind of place.
And if you're not gambling, how long do you spend in Las Vegas to make it a good, fun trip and you go home with good memories?
You know what I did was I actually went to Las Vegas, as I said, with friends for 2.5 days. And we really packed a lot in. And we didn't gamble that much, but we had some great meals. As I said, we went to see Cirque du Soleil. We went and saw a lot of artwork, Picasso's. You know, Steve Wynn is a huge, huge art collector. Then I got in a car, and we drove out to sort of the Red Rocks area and hiked for 4 or 5 hours, which is terrific. And it's a sort of a wonderful balance between the, you know, it's the slot canyons and the slot machines.
Let's come back to Sacramento. Again, what I think of as the polar opposite of Las Vegas. What did you find to like in Sacramento?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you think of Las Vegas, you think of lawlessness. And, of course, Sacramento is all law because it's the capital of California. This is a place that I just didn't know about. You know, it's you think of Los Angeles, you think of San Francisco, you don't think of Sacramento. And probably you, if you do, it's because it's where Arnold lives. But there's a wonderful thing we said in the article. It's like Eureka. I found it, which is a state motto, and it's legitimate. Okay, so it's a former gold rush town. It's the capital, but it's also a place that's now first of all, you get this wonderful old area called Old Sacramento, which is a ton of historic buildings, and this of course was a Pony Express sort of stop, and it has that flavor of the old California. And we forget that a lot of the old California has been papered over in asphalt, but this still has a little of that flavor, and I really like that a lot.
Can you make a weekend of it?
Oh, you can definitely make a weekend of it. I mean, it depends on what kind of weekend you want, but I was sort of very intrigued with the historic character of it. But you know, my wife, it's the shopping thing, of course, and there's some wonderful little places, a place she, and we mentioned in the magazine, is a place called Riki Design, which is clothing, and there's a custom furniture place, which we also mentioned in the magazine, called House. Lot of good shopping there, pretty good restaurants, neat hotels. In fact, one of my favorites was the Delta King, which is sort of the alter ego of the Mississippi Riverboat, the Delta Queen, $109 a night. You know, you can hit the California Hall of Fame, which is, you know, and who is in the California Hall of Fame? You got Ronald Reagan and Amelia Earhart and Clint Eastwood.
Well, I have to ask you, did you have an Arnold sighting?
I didn't, but you can't. Supposedly, you can. Obviously, you can hang around the state capitol building. Supposedly, if you stay at the Hyatt Regency, Sacramento, there's an outdoor pool there, and that's where he sort of goes to do business in the middle of the day. So you can sort of catch him there. And you can always go by his office because you won't necessarily see him, but you can get his business card for free.
Let's talk about one more city that you covered in your City Life column this month, Budapest. With a couple of days there, what impressions do you come away with?
You know, Budapest is one of those places like Warsaw. I mean, well, first of all, you love a town whose name is Budapest because it's actually made from Pest and Buddha. So you reverse that. I didn't find any pests there. It is a really classic city in the true sense of old world. We think of that when we think of Paris. You go back a little farther, you think of Prague. But this Budapest is sort of frozen in time a little bit. And, you know, it has a huge Jewish community. It's got great history there. It's got the second largest synagogue in the world. There's a Raoul Wallenberg Park there, which is, you know, he was the Swedish diplomat that really saved thousands and thousands of Jewish lives during the war. It has that old world charm and that resonance that I'm always looking for when I go to Europe. I mean, it's you know, the kosher restaurants, the little butchers, the tiny gardens, the castles. There's Buda Castle, for instance. You know, you can go to these small little stores and you'll find the prints and the maps that, you know, are really, really hard to find in the New World. The things that sort of have been in somebody's attic for forever. Great coffee houses. It just sort of feels like, I just got off the train and it's 1932.
Well, the fares are cheap. It's time to go.
The fares are cheap, but the euro is a stiff price.
Yeah, well, the euro is another story. You've got to think about it as, you know, one offsets the other, right?
Exactly. And if you take your own food, then you're ahead of the game. But no, the fares are cheap, and this is the time to go, because it's not going to get any cheaper.
Keith, we'll talk to you next month.
I'm looking forward to it, Carol.
Keith Bellows is editor of National Geographic Traveler. After a short break, we'll talk with Wayne Senville about his trip through America across Route 50. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Wayne Senville is editor of the Planning Commissioner's Journal and PlannersWeb.com. This summer, you traveled Route 50 from Maryland to California. You live in Vermont, so why Route 50?
Well, it relates to the fact that I'm editor of a national publication called the Planning Commissioner's Journal. So we're covering planning and land use issues nationwide. I was looking for a way to just get a sense of the type of issues that were coming up across the country. And Route 50 had some real strong attractions to me in that it cuts across the heart of the country, goes from coast to coast, goes through large cities, small cities, rural areas, suburban communities. And it seemed like a good way to get a feel for the type of planning and land use issues that are affecting all different sorts of communities. And that's an important thing as editor of a national publication. I mean, I'm located, as you said, in Vermont, and naturally I'm more familiar with issues in New England. I do go to conferences like most planners do, but, you know, you get information more secondhand that way. So I decided to set aside 6 weeks of time and just work my way across the country, probably stopped at more than two dozen communities along the way.
And what are those emerging issues?
I think a number of the issues are ones that listeners to your show and planners and local government officials are familiar with. It's the type of land use pattern we have. How do we build stronger communities? How do you have, a strong and healthy local economy? So those type of issues certainly came up during my travels.
And did you get some answers?
It was a very revealing trip to me. I think a lot of what I saw was what, you know, you'd expect to see in traveling across the United States these days. We have sort of the spread out pattern of land use, plenty of commercial strip development, a lot of unattractive areas, certainly. But what was sort of more interesting and revealing to me was that the core of our communities especially in small cities, is still there. It's a question of what do we do with it? And one of the very encouraging things that I saw in place after place was that there really there's a lot of citizens, planning commissioners, elected officials who are really interested in strengthening their communities. One thing that I heard in place after place, and I sort of reported on this on my blog and will certainly be reporting on it in the Planning Commissioner's Journal next issue, is this interest in establishing a strong sense of community identity. It's something I heard time and again, and communities were looking for different approaches to get at that.
What are some of those approaches?
Well, there were different ways of doing it. One thing that was fascinating to me, and I hadn't really been aware of its impact, was when smaller cities engage in major projects like restoring historic theaters in their downtown or Main Street areas. I came across that in a couple of places. I was in a small central Indiana city, probably population about 6,000 or 7,000, North Vernon, where the citizens basically sort of led by an amazingly dynamic 80-year-old lady, Hulda Reichenbach, had organized to restore a theater that had been just sort of standing vacant for years and years. And that was a really major community undertaking for a small town. Now, they got some support from the state. They received support from a local community foundation, but it took a tremendous amount of work. And basically, working on this project over a period of years helped bring the community together. It started to sort of jumpstart efforts downtown, and it was just really a remarkable accomplishment. And so much the same thing in a somewhat larger place, but also a small city, Emporia, Kansas, where the community residents there have really banded together to work on getting their theater together. Now, sort of on the other, you know, in a similar type of way of building community identity, but in a totally different type of community, came up in some of the suburban communities that I visited. Two in particular that I passed through, Crèvecœur, Missouri, and Lenexa, Kansas, both sort of growing suburbs. But both, when I was talking to the members of the planning commissions in those communities and the city planners, they both said that, you know, what we're really lacking in our suburbs is a sense of identity as a community. We want to sort of anchor people more in the community. I think that was part of what was behind efforts in both of those suburbs to basically plan for new downtown centers. They're looking to develop mixed-use, higher density housing than in the rest of the community. They're looking for walkable types of places. I heard a planning commissioner in Crèvecœur, for example, say that they want places in the community where people, as they grow older, aren't forced to leave the community. In other words, they want a greater mix of housing types, and they see developing a new downtown center there as one way to accomplish it. But, you know, again, in both of those places, one thing that kept on coming up is we need to, you know, strengthen a sense of community. And that's what they were hearing from their constituents. That's what they told me citizens were saying at public meetings. And they were also hearing it from their local elected officials.
Isn't there some irony that people who left cities are now trying to duplicate them?
I think people also enjoy the suburban lifestyle and sort of the open spaces and the lower density. So I don't know if it's that they want to leave that behind. I think they want to create more choices within their community so that, yes, at a certain point in your life, if you want sort of the, you know, what we view as sort of a typical suburban, you know, lifestyle with lower density pattern, that's still going to be there.
On your visit through Ohio, you wrote about a fascinating new movement that is emerging, coalitions of inner first-ring suburbs around some of our older, large cities. Such First Suburbs coalitions exist in the metro areas of Cleveland, Columbus, Dayton, Cincinnati. Why are they forming, Wayne, and what do they hope to accomplish?
Well, it is a very interesting phenomenon that seems to be spreading. I mean, I also, when I was in the Kansas City area, we talked about it. I think one of the goals is just simple political clout. As you know, and you know, as your listeners know, we live in the United States. We have so many fragmented jurisdictions. At the same time, there's a reluctance in a lot of places to create metropolitan-wide governments. I mean, people want local control is an important issue in lots of parts of the country, and I think for good reason. So these are more voluntary ways of people to feel more comfortable in coming together to address problems. In the Cincinnati area, I think, you know, they were working on, you know, ways of facilitating things for as basic as consolidating fire departments, which can be controversial, to just giving voice to some of the issues that sort of first suburbs face. One of the things that was very interesting when I met with the folks in the Cincinnati area was they pointed to the fact that, you know, when you talk about first suburbs, that's still a wide variety of types of communities. And in the Cincinnati area, you have some very wealthy, well-off first suburbs, inner ring suburbs, and you have some that are really struggling. So they found it was a very interesting experience to directly hear and be able to support each other. So they were able to really give voice, give greater voice to each other by joining together in this sort of voluntary cooperation.
Let's jump back to your preparation for the trip. You shared on your blog in some detail the technology that you plan to use and your learning the technology. What ended up being indispensable?
Well, certainly a laptop was indispensable, and I had my moment of panic. I was planning for a nice relaxing week or two before leaving, and then my laptop died on me. So certainly, you know, when you're traveling across the country now, it is kind of remarkable how easy it is to connect, you know, to the internet. There are wireless connections in all sorts of places. I guess two equally important tools that I used was, one, a digital camera, and I'm a photographic junkie. And as you can tell from the blog, there are lots and lots of photos, and those represent only a fraction of what I talk. And I think that having photos is very important in terms of illustrating the text. And then the third tool I had is something I would have had if I had done this trip 15 or 20 years ago, and that's my reporter's notepad. And believe me, I was very busy scrawling notes, but sometimes the oldest tools are still the most important ones to have.
What was most disturbing to you?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think I've been asked that before about the trip. Well, I posted on the blog something that I will need to do some follow-up research on. I was traveling through East St. Louis, Illinois, which is in the St. Louis metropolitan area. And on entering the city, I was wondering, why is it that you know, none of the traffic signals are working? And there are stop signs at every single intersection, four-way stop signs. And then when I got into St. Louis, I asked a person I was meeting with, well, what's going on in East St. Louis? And I was told that the community can't afford to pay electric bills as a community. And it was a very striking contrast to me, too, because that morning I was visiting in a suburb, O'Fallon, Illinois, which is, you know, driving through neighborhoods with $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 homes, and then you just travel down Route 50 heading into St. Louis about 10 miles down the road, and you're in a urban wasteland where there's abandoned buildings left and right. So I don't really know all the background to it, and I'd be curious, you know, to, you know, if you end up hearing from any of your listeners on some of the background on East St. Louis and it could well reflect local government failures. But for us as a society, to have areas like that there for whatever reason, I think reflects a real failing.
You said you were surprised at the central role hospitals played in the evaluation by local citizens of their quality of life, even more so than schools. Is that, do you think, a function of an aging population, the age of the people you talk to, or something else?
I think it's certainly partly a demographic change. When I was meeting with, for example, the chair of the Planning Commission in Montrose, Colorado, which is a sort of a growing small city on the western slope of Colorado. He had moved to Montrose about 7 or 8 years earlier. I might be a bit off on that. And he told me that, you know, he was looking ahead with his wife, planning for, you know, how they were going to deal with aging. And a key issue was there a strong regional hospital in their community? And I heard that from planners in other communities, that that's an important issue people are looking for. I think over the years, we're certainly all familiar that people look to the quality of K-12 schools for their kids. And I think, you know, almost as important, maybe as important to people, is having strong regional medical centers and good quality health care. And so it's important in terms of that. The other interesting aspect of it is, in a number of communities, you ask, when I ask planners, well, what are the major employers in your city? And the regional medical center was almost always up there as one of the top two or three employers. So it's an important economic engine for communities as well.
You also said that the value of arts and culture in a revitalized downtown play a big role in a city's ability to attract doctors to those hospitals and to attract other mobile, highly skilled citizens. That was a bit of a surprise to you. What evidence did you see for that?
Well, I think one of the themes, or one of the things that I heard about, and this sort of ties in, you know, again, to the quality of life thing, is that we're living in a competitive environment. Communities are competing for jobs and for people. That I heard that in a number of places. For example, when I was in Parkersburg, West Virginia, which is a city of about 30,000, that it's a city that's really was hit hard over the last 20, 30 years by sort of industrial plant closings in terms of the chemical industry in West Virginia, that part of West Virginia. So they're looking for ways to rebuild, you know, their city, especially their downtown. I was meeting with the head of the County Economic Development Authority, and he told me, look, we are competing for jobs here. The community needs to figure out what it is that's going to attract people who could live in many different places and have a wide range of choices. What's going to make Parkersburg, West Virginia, attractive to these people? And it was kind of interesting to me. They said that what they needed the downtown to be was I heard it both from the city planner, from the person in the chamber. I met with the mayor there. They said their view of the downtown was to be like a business park with amenities. And it's kind of, it took me aback at first when I heard that phrase. But then when they sort of explained it, it sort of had a certain logic to it. They weren't worried about getting sort of traditional retail downtown. Parkersburg, like many of the places I visited, like many of the communities that people listening to your show live in or are familiar with, I mean, we've got sort of big boxes, superstores. We've got all of these type of retail, popular retail uses in suburban areas. I mean, I'm talking to you from Burlington, Vermont. I mean, we've got that in a number of our suburbs. But in Parkersburg, their view was, let's not fight that. That's what people want for their shopping. Let's focus on creating a different type of downtown something that's going to work for us. So what they came up with as a strategy was to create a downtown that was a hub for government employment, for other companies, like they have, they've attracted a major regional Blue Cross Blue Shield. And they're also building on their cultural amenities. They've got two theaters downtown. They have an art center. So, and they're starting to have, you know, some places for people to eat. So they want to create a 24/7 downtown. They want to have a certain amount of housing downtown. I mean, it's certainly only going to be a small component, you know, of the housing market, city and county wide. But they haven't given up on their town downtown. And that was one of the things that was heartening in a lot of places. I mean, there are strong, you know, active efforts to make better downtowns. But, you know, they've come up with sort of a game plan and a direction to go in. And it largely, you know, ties into sort of these cultural quality of life amenities.
Do you think their attitude toward downtown retail may one day change, just as their attitude toward housing types and amenities and community identity has changed?
Boy, it's really hard to, you know, to predict long-range trends. I mean, certainly personally, I'm hopeful that, you know, we can have a strong retail component downtown. And, you know, in Vermont, that's an important agenda. I think, you know, each community has to, you know, decide its own path to chart. And, you know, that in Parkersburg and other places, you know, not everyone's picking the same direction, but that's, you know, something that they feel will work for them. And it's something that I think has the potential of really building their downtown. And, you know, and like I had said, Carol, you know, they were really hammered hard. You know, the work that they're doing, I thought was really, really positive. Maybe 10 or 20 years from now, they'll, you know, try to, you know, build back retail.
Did you come back energized or in despair about what you saw in America?
Oh, no, definitely energized. You know, I think I expected, I mean, I certainly saw a lot of what I expected in terms of the strip development and sort of the hodgepodge of land uses. And I think as a nation, there are not many bright examples of, you know, of how we address that. So that's all out there, and it's a major planning challenge for communities. And we're, you know, there are small positive steps being taken. But I think what was more heartening to me was both that we still have intact city centers, main streets in small towns, and that people are working on strengthening them and reviving them and investing in them.
Wayne Senville is editor of the Planning Commissioner's Journal and PlannersWeb.com. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Do you want to feel more connected to your community? CityView's commentator Walker Smith says, put on your shoes.
Walking distance is the measure of my world. The places where I spend the most time around town are all within walking distance of my house. I'm a short walk away from the post office and the drugstore, along with several restaurants and churches. A longer walk will get me to a nearby park or to the movie theater. It's a 10-minute walk to the grocer and a 20-minute walk to a cluster of bookstores and specialty shops. On the weekends, my wife and I like to walk and explore different areas in our neighborhood, and often without realizing it, we'll get so far out that we have to stop somewhere for lunch on the way back home. Walking distance is the scale by which I can best gauge my world. I can fathom the length of a mile or of 5 miles because I've walked that far. I know the pitch and grade of various slopes and inclines because I've worked those angles on my walks around town. I can figure out the relationship between time and distance because I've learned how long it takes me to walk a certain distance and how much or how little I can hurry it up when I'm running late. Walking distance puts things on a human scale for me. Afoot, I am embedded in things, not passing them by or viewing them from afar. I am connected concretely, not abstracted completely. And it's not just my neighborhood. I've discovered that walking is the best way for me to take the measure of everything. Manhattan is more intelligible and accommodating on foot. The Grand Canyon is more sublime when seen on a walk to the river than from a rail at the rim. The Outer Banks don't come alive until you get out of the car and wade in the surf. There is an intimacy to walking distance that offers the kinds of connection to life that more and more of us are seeking nowadays. Increasingly, we want to make personal connections with others. We want more of the pleasures in our lives to be the small, everyday indulgences. We want more of the richness and texture of the neighborhoods and communities in which we live. A good friend of mine is avid about mountaineering. He's a bushwhacker, not a hiker. He plans his trips with topo maps, not trail guides. He wants to get to know the land, so he seeks routes that will put him in intimate contact with the terrain. Sometimes he walks into trouble, but what keeps him safe is his focus on his very next step. This is something I've learned from him. Whether it's mountaineering or running errands, walking distance is all about your next step. Doesn't matter how steep the slope or how far the distance, you're never in danger as long as you have a safe place to take your next step. Our communities give us the intimacy we crave when we feel confident about taking the next step. This is an imperative for communities to grow and develop in ways that put people first by engaging us on a human scale. Because only then will the best part of life always be within our reach, no more than walking distance away. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich and author of the forthcoming book, Generation Ageless, in bookstores October 2nd. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.